The soul asks in this line for everything she possibly can ask of him. She is no longer satisfied with the knowledge and communication of the back of God, which was his communication to Moses. Exodus 33:23. And which is knowledge of him in his effects and works. She can only be satisfied with God's face, which is an essential communication of the divinity of the soul. This communication is not brought about through any means, but through a certain contact of the soul with the divinity. This contact is something foreign to everything sensory and accidental, since it is a touch of naked substance of the soul and the divinity. Consequently, she adds, This means do not speak as before, when the communications you granted me were such that you spoke them to the exterior senses, that is, you spoke things apprehensible to the senses, since these things were not so high and deep that the sensory part could not attain to them. But now let these communications be so lofty and substantial and interior that you do not speak of them to the senses, that is, such that the senses may be unable to attain to the knowledge of them. Spiritual substance cannot be communicated to the senses, anything imparted to sense, especially in this life, cannot be pure spirit, since sense is incapable of it. The soul, then, desiring this communication of God, which is so substantial and essential that it is imperceptible to sense, asks the bridegroom to refrain from speaking, which is like saying, let the depth of this hiding place, which is spiritual union, be of such a kind that the senses will be unable to feel or speak of it, as with the secrets heard by St. Paul, about which it was unlawful for man to speak. 2 Corinthians 12:4. But look at those companions. When God looks, he loves and grants favors. And the companions whom the soul tells God to look at are the many virtues, the gifts, perfections, and other spiritual riches he has placed in her as the pledges, tokens, and jewels of espousal. Thus this verse is like saying, but beloved, first turn to the interior of my soul, and be enamored of the company, the riches that you have placed there, so that loving the soul through them, you may dwell and hide in her. For indeed, even though they are yours, since you gave them to her, they also belong to her. Going with her through strange islands, that is, they belong to the soul that goes to you by means of strange knowledge of you and by modes and ways that are foreign to all the senses and to common natural knowledge. And thus it is as though, desiring to oblige him, she were to say, since I go to you through a spiritual knowledge strange and foreign to the senses, let your communication be so interior and sublime as to be foreign to all of them. Stanza 20 and 21, Introduction. The attainment of so high a state of perfection as that which the soul here aims after, which is spiritual marriage, requires the purification of all the imperfections, rebellions, and imperfect habits of the lower part, which, by putting off the old man, is surrendered and made subject to the higher part. But there is also needed a singular fortitude and a very sublime love for so strong and intimate an embrace from God. The soul obtains not only a very lofty purity and beauty, but also an amazing strength because of the powerful and intimate bond effected between God and her by means of this union. In order that she reaches him, it is necessary for her to attain an adequate degree of purity, fortitude, and love. The Holy Spirit, he who intervenes to effect this spiritual union, desiring that the soul attain the possession of these qualities in order to merit this union, speaks to the Father and the Son in the canticle. What shall we do for our sister on the day of her courtship? For she is little and has no breasts. For she is a wall. Let us build upon it silver bulwarks and defences, as if she is a door. Let us reinforce it with cedar wood. Canticles 8:8-9. The silver bulwarks and defences refer to the strong and heroic virtues clothed with faith, which is signified by the silver. These heroic virtues are those of spiritual marriage, and their foundation is in the strong soul, referred to by the wall. The peaceful bridegroom rests in the strength of these virtues without any weakness disturbing him. The cedar wood applies to the affections and properties of lofty love. This lofty love is signified by cedar, and it is the love proper to spiritual marriage. The bride must first be a door in order to receive the reinforcement of cedar wood. That is, she must hold the door of her will open to the bridegroom, that he may enter through the complete and true yes of love. This is the yes of espousal, which is given before the spiritual marriage. The breasts of the bride also refer to this perfect love, which she should possess in order to appear before the bridegroom, Christ, for the consummation of this state. The text, however, mentions that the bride answered immediately by stating her desire to be courted. I am a wall, and my breasts are as a tower. Canticle 8:10. This means, my soul is strong and my love lofty, and I should not be held back. Desiring this perfect union and transformation, the bride also manifested this strength in the preceding stanzas, especially in the one just explained, in which, to oblige her spouse further, she sets before him the virtues and preparative riches received from him. As a result, the bridegroom, desiring to conclude this matter, speaks the two following stanzas, in which he finishes purifying the soul, strengthening and disposing her in both sensory and spiritual parts for this state. He speaks these lines against all the opposition and rebellion from the sensory part and the devil. Swift-winged birds lions, stags, and leaping roes, mountains, lowlands, and river banks, waters, winds, and ardors, watching fears of night. By the pleasant lyres and the siren song, I conjure you to cease your anger and not touch the wall, that the bride may sleep in deeper peace. Commentary. In these two stanzas, the bridegroom, the Son of God, gives the bride soul possession of peace and tranquility by conforming the lower part to the higher, cleansing it of all the imperfections, bringing under rational control the natural faculties and motives, and quieting all the other appetites mentioned in these two stanzas. The meaning of these stanzas is as follows. First, the bridegroom conjures and commands the useless wanderings of the fantasy and imaginative power to cease once and for all. He also puts under the control of reason the two natural powers, the irascible and the concupiscible, which were previously somewhat of an affliction to the soul. And in so far as is possible in this life, he perfects the three faculties, the memory, intellect, and will, in regard to their objects. What is more, he conjures and commands the four passions, joy, hope, fear, and sorrow, that from now on they be mitigated and controlled by reason. Such is the meaning of the terms used in the first of these stanzas. The bridegroom makes these disturbing activities and movements cease by means of the immense delight and sweetness and strength received in the spiritual communication and surrender he makes of himself at this time. Because God vitally transforms the soul into himself, all these faculties, appetites, and movements lose their natural imperfection and are changed to divine. And thus he says, swift-winged birds. He calls the wanderings of the imagination swift-winged birds, for these digressions are quick and restless in flying from one place to another. When the will is enjoying in quietude the delightful communication of the Beloved, these wanderings usually displease her by their restless flights and put an end to her satisfaction. The bridegroom says that he conjures them by the pleasant lyres, by sweetness and delight so abundant and frequent that they cannot be the impediment they were before she reached so high a state, to cease their restless flights, impulses, and excesses. This should be understood similarly regarding the other verses that we will comment on here, such as lions, stags, and leaping roes. By the lions, he refers to the acrimony and impetuosity of the irascible power, for in its acts this power is bold, daring like the lion. By the stag, and by the leaping roes, he refers to that other power, the concupiscible, which is an appetitive power. This faculty causes two classes of effect, the one of cowardice and the other of daring. It produces the effects of cowardice when things are found difficult, for it then retires, withdraws within itself, and becomes cowardly. Because of these effects, this faculty is comparable to stags. For since the stag has a more intense concupiscible power than many other animals, it is very cowardly and withdrawn. This faculty produces the effects of daring when things are found easy, for then it does not withdraw and becomes cowardly, but makes bold to admit these things by its appetites and affections. And because of these effects, this faculty is compared to the roe, which have such concupiscence that they do not merely run after their desire, but even leap after them. And thus he calls them leaping roes. In conjuring the lions, he bridles the impulses and excesses of anger, and in conjuring the stags, he strengthens the concupiscible power against the cowardice and pusillanimity which previously made it withdrawn. And in conjuring the leaping roe, he satisfies the appetites previously restless and leaping like roes from one thing to another, trying to satisfy concupiscence. This concupiscence is now satisfied by the pleasant lyre, whose sweetness it enjoys, and by the siren song, the delight of which it feeds on. It should be observed that the bridegroom does not conjure anger and concupiscence to cease, for these powers are never wanting to the soul, but he conjures their disturbances and inordinate actions, signified by the lions, stags, and leaping roes. It is necessary that in this state these inordinate movements be lacking. Mountains, lowlands, and river banks. These expressions denote the vicious and inordinate acts of the three faculties, memory, intellect, and will. These acts are inordinate and vicious when they reach either a high level or a low level, or even when they are inclined toward one of them without actually reaching it. Thus the mountains which are high refer to acts that are extreme through an inordinate excess. The lowlands, being low, refer to the acts that are extreme through defect. The river banks, which are neither high nor low, but still not level, participate somewhat in both extreme and refer to the acts that exceed or lack something of the mean or right measure. Although these are not extremely inordinate, as would be the case with mortal sin, they are nonetheless partly so, either through venial sin or through imperfection, however slight, in the intellect, memory, and will. He also conjures by means of the pleasant lyre and the siren song all these acts in excess of the just measure to cease. These lyres perfect the three faculties of the soul by bringing them to an operation which lies in the just measure, without extremes or even any part in the extremes. The remaining verses follow: waters, winds, and ardors, watching, fears of night. These four references indicate the four passions: sorrow, hope, joy, and fear. The waters denote the emotions. These four references indicate the four passions: sorrow, hope, joy, and fear. The waters denote the emotions of sorrow, which afflict the soul, for they enter like water. David, referring to them, says to God, Save me, my God, for the waters have come in even unto my soul. Psalm 68. The winds allude to the emotions of hope, for like the wind they fly toward the absent object. David also says, I opened the mouth of my hope and drew in the breath of my desire, because I longed and hoped for your commandments. Psalm 118. The ardors refer to the emotions of the passion of joy, which inflamed the heart like fire. David says, my heart grew hot within me, and in my meditation a fire shall be enkindled. Psalm 38. This is like saying, in my meditation joy shall be enkindled. By the watching fears of night are understood the emotions of fear, the other passion. These fears are usually very great in spiritual persons who have not reached the state of spiritual marriage of which we are speaking. Sometimes when God wishes to grant them some favor, he causes fear and trembling in the spirit, and also shriveling in the flesh and the senses, because the sensory part is not fortified, perfected, and habituated to such favor. Sometimes too, the devil, being envious and sad over the soul's peace and good, when God grants it recollection and sweetness in himself, strives to put horror and fear in the spirit in order to hinder that good. Sometimes he does this as though he were threatening her there in the spirit. When he becomes aware of his inability to reach the inmost part of the soul because of her deep recollection and union with God, he tries to cause distraction, wandering, conflicts, sorrow, and dread, at least in the sensory part, in order to disturb the bride in her bridal chamber. He calls these emotions fears of night because they are produced by the devil, who endeavors by their means to diffuse an obscurity in the soul and darken the divine light she enjoys. He calls them watching fears because of themselves they awaken her from her peaceful interior sleep, and also because the devils are always awake and watching for their chance to cause these fear. These fears, as I said, are passively introduced by God or the devil into the soul of those who are already spiritual. I am not speaking here of other temporal or natural fears, for such fears are not characteristic of spiritual people, but these spiritual fears are.